Excision number 22371, reel 4.
Mr. Howe, reel. Mr. Howe, reel 4.
My goodness. That's right, that time of drill was very unpleasant in that you were shot out by day and when you went round by night, you see, I used to visit my guns and take them supplies. Now, this is worth telling, I think. And the Germans would put up a flare, you know, a parachute flare, and they were surprisingly brilliant. From complete darkness to suddenly this flare, which lit up the countryside, it didn't last very long. I suppose about a minute, something like that. I can't remember, but it seemed an eternity. And what you had to do was stay absolutely still with your face turned away from it and hope they didn't recognise you. They said you're hoping you'd blend into the countryside. And I suppose it worked.
Because your face would shine.
Your face would shine, you see. So otherwise the camouflage of your outfits and helmets and everything would do it. So one other subject of these flares, that first night before I deployed my guns, and I was trying to get back, the Germans put up one of these parachute flares, and I was just up on, just got onto the road to come back to it. I was on foot, so I dropped down the side of the road, which is rather a steep hill slope. Down into the ditch, you know, a real Dutch ditch, you know, that's deep, filled with water. And of course, I slipped down, sort of somewhat out of control, while this flare was lighting up the countryside. And I could see what looked like a log, so I trod on it. But the log turned over. It was a German soldier with a bullet hole in his head, which didn't cheer me up no end at all. Anyway, I recovered from that, and, you know, what I had to do was go and get my guns and get them deployed, so I went back and did it. But as I say, these flares were quite effective. Anyway, almost every night when we went out to give, you know, take supplies round to the chaps in the forward areas, there were always these flares went up. Anyway, we survived that. And everybody remained quite cheerful, and the Americans were quite strong, and they got in control of the situation. So the danger declined, the immediate danger declined, and there were a lot of prisoners of war taken at that time. One of our sergeants. We used to make them turn out their pockets. Now, they had all looted all masses of watches and rings and God knows what. And so these became the property of various British soldiers, or American soldiers as well, for that matter. And that is part of war, I suppose. The only thing that the British troops complained about was the American rations. Now, they used to give us what they call sea rations, which was three little tins a day, about the size of a pork bean tin, baked bean tin. And in it, it contained all sorts of dehydrated foods. But it was designed for an American palate, an American constitution, and coffee, and lemonade, and powder, and all things like this. And the British lads were quite happy to go along with this, except it had no tea. And they took that as being a great hardship. Could we have some tea? So, the following day, I went back to where the quartermaster was. It must have been far enough back, because he had loads of stuff laid out on the field around him, so he wasn't subject to being shelled. And I said, "Can I have any tea?" And he said, "Well, look, there's plenty of tea in those boxes over there. You can have those, we don't want them." And these were compo boxes. Now, if you don't know what a compo box is, it was a special ration pack designed by Joe Lyons for one man for 14 days, or 14 men for one day, and contained all the sort of things that British squaddies liked. There were various grades of them, but you could have steak kidney casserole, or beef casserole, chicken casserole, all in tins, which you could have cold or hot, as was required. And there were exotic sort of puddings, British type puddings, like treacle suet and plum duff, to a man who's cold and wet, it's rather nice to get things like that, you see. So there was well thought out. Anyway, in amongst it, of course, was all this tea. So I helped myself to as many packs, compo packs, as I could get on the jeep, and went and gave them out to my men. I said, there you are, there's your rations, that's it. They were happy enough. The gun was replaced, and in the fullness of time we pulled out of there. Oh, I had acquired a telephone. This might amuse you. The code word for that particular battalion was Geronimo. They made a great thing about this great Indian fighter, and he became sort of the hero of American airborne forces. And so the code name for that battalion was Geronimo. And so I became Geronimo Pronto. Frankly, I still laugh when I hear the words. You know, it's sort of the strangest code words you could ever think of. But anyway, straight out of a cowboy film. And when my phone went, I used to say Geronimo Pronto, and then fall about with laughter. Well, I didn't get a lot of phone calls, but odd ones from the battalion commander or something like this. And in the fullness of time, we pulled out of Driel, and we went somewhere rather south of there on some high ground. And for the life of me, I couldn't tell you where it is. You know, we weren't very far, but it was high ground and away from, you know, away from all the shelling and the gore of around Driel. We were relieved, in fact, by the 50th Northumberland Division, the Tyne and Tees Division. And not sorry to leave the area, although I've been back many times. It looks quite peaceful now. Anyway, in the area we withdrew to, we were in reserve, and the colonel said to me, "You know, you can all relax now, and we'll have a little rest. Just make yourselves comfortable." So we settled into a farmhouse, and I had this telephone beside me. And one morning, very early, it went. One morning, very early, my phone went, and a voice, and I said, "Geronimo Pronto," and bit back my laughter. And someone said, "The CCRA wishes to speak to you." And I don't know whether you know it or not, but that is a very, very senior man in the Royal Artillery. I couldn't believe it. I thought there was a joke. Anyway, he came on, and he said, "I'm sorry, I didn't know you were there." He said, "I've only just heard that you were there. Apparently someone had reported that we were there attached to this American division." Because by this time, the 1st Airborne Division had returned to England, and, you know, was licking its wounds in England, after, you know, the debacle of Arnhem and the withdrawal and so on. He said, "You've got to return to England. They want every man they can in the division." I said, "All right." Otherwise, I was quite enjoying myself. You know, I had no real great wish to return to England at that the moment. But anyway, so he said, can you come down and see me this morning? So I trundled down and I found him somewhere tucked away south of Nijmegen, somewhere down towards Eindhoven, I think. Anyway, he told his staff, you know, just organise this boat to go back to England and take his troop with him, you see. So I said, well, they said, how long will it take you to get to Ostend? And I said, no idea, where's Ostend? Imagine, the Germans held a great slice of Holland and the top end of Belgium at that time. And he said, well, you have to go round that. It'll take you 2 days. That's all right. So he said, all right, I'll organise you shipping. You go and you report to whoever you report to. So I trundled on back. And by this time I felt, you know, I was out of things. And I suddenly saw that there was a battery of, it was called Q Sanus Post Battery, and I had served in it. They had SPs, that's a self-propelled gun, 17-pounders guns on tracks with which to hunt down tanks. I found it quite interesting. I took time off to inspect their equipment, and I knew one or two people there whom I'd known when I was Gunner Howe or Lance Bombardier Howe. So Lieutenant Howe didn't make that much difference. They had fought the whole campaign from Normandy right up till there in a lot of famous battles. Anyway, I then went back and got my troop and said, look, tonight we're going to spend tonight in Brussels, or Louvain it would have been. And it was pointed out to me that several of the jeeps had leaky radiators. Shell splinters, you know, however tiny, just make holes, and you don't need enough holes, and, you know, the water drains out very quickly. I had tried to get them repaired, and the chap said to me, well, the waiting list is 3 to 6 months long, you know, you just take your place in the queue. So I thought, well, we'll manage. So I went back and said, I'm sorry, you blokes won't be able to come back, because because your vehicles won't get there. We'll get there all right. So they were patched up with clay and chewing gum, and everybody carried a 5 gallon can of water. And we just bowled on down and spent the night down there, down somewhere between Louvain and Brussels. Trundled on the next day and arrived in Ostend about lunchtime, I think, to find that there wasn't a boat waiting for us at all. You know, he'd probably done the best he could, but there was no boat even scheduled. I don't think the harbour had even been cleared of, you know, whatever the Germans had done to it. So we settled into some sort of barracks and had a look around Ostend for a few days. There's not a lot to see in Ostend that I was aware of. Or if there was, I missed it. Now, by that time, you see, it was the end of October. And, you know, the weather was closing in. And it wasn't the sort of time for great sightseeing. In the fullness of time, there was a ship. And the cargo was cleared. And it was a naval landing ship tank. You know, they're big things, great big open holds that you drive in. So we drove in there, we were the only people in it, and they were returning to England. I suppose having brought somebody across, and they were going back for another load. And we finally ended up at Tilbury the next day sometime. The customs and excise came on board, which tried to tickle me. I thought, well, you know, bureaucracy does its duty. And we then went into a transit camp at Tilbury, which was absolutely repulsive. It was mud everywhere. it had seen its best time. I dare say it had been put up for D-Day and been overused, and the rain had not made it any better. And I thought, hell's teeth, we can live better than this ourselves in the countryside. I'd been doing it for long enough. So then I gathered the men together, and I found everyone's reaction had been the same. They'd gone off to various messes to try and get a meal. He was squelching through this mud, and they had to end up with cold steel or something like that. It was not very exciting. Particularly when we had enough rations on our vehicles to feed ourselves. We didn't need them. So I said, well, let's go. So we tunneled off. And the chap, who was my driver, said to me, oh, I joined the army just down here at Worley Barracks. I said, oh, did you? Well, let's go and spend the night at Worley Barracks. It's the depot of the Essex Regiment. Quite regimental. And I rolled over there, and I spoke to the sentry. He treated me with great suspicion. And he said, wait here, and they produced the sergeant of the guard, and wait here. And we waited a long time. I got a bit fed up with this. But anyway, agitated. And anyway, they kept saying, no, just wait. We then went in, and you know, they had prepared a barrack room and made up the beds. A fire. And for the first time, for quite a long time, my blokes slept in a bed, you know, in the warmth. And they said, don't be too long, because the ATS have cooked you a special supper. Which is quite nice, isn't it?
Yes.
And really, we just wanted a room somewhere where we could just look after ourselves, you know. We're not expecting anything like that. Anyway, they said to me, the colonel wishes you to have dinner with him. Well, I was... My clothes were not mess-style clothes at all. I had a great gash in my trousers that a shell splinter had torn, which I'd cobbled together with cotton. It wasn't a particularly brilliant piece of sewing, but it was adequate. I didn't have any other trousers with me. So... with the help of one of the batmen there, we got the mud off it and did the best we could. And went in and had a very nice dinner with the old boy, who was a veteran of the First World War. And the chaps who were there were all sort of young officers who'd been wounded in Normandy and were now on their way back in to rejoin their units. So, you know, they were interesting, a lot of people to talk to.
So, were they Essex Regiment? Or
Essex Regiment, yeah. The army was very mixed up then. It wouldn't necessarily be Essex Regiment. They would just be infantrymen on their way. And that's where they went. But yes, the Essex Regiment. Well, anyway, they were very good to us. And the next morning, as we sort of gather ourselves together to drive off, the colonel walked past, and he noticed that we had a German machine gun that we'd picked up on our... Well, that we had captured, actually. So he gave it to him with a belt of ammunition. You know, you see them in many films. It's a sort of standard light machine gun, but they all operate on this with a big belt of ammunition. So we had both. Must have had a box of ammunition. Anyway, in thanks for, you know, the hospitality. And then forgot all about it. But I found out years later that machine gun is in the museum of the Essex Regiment, if ever you were to go there, which is where Worley Barracks used to be, which is now Ford Motor Company. And, you know, that part of Essex. We then pushed off. And nowadays, with motorways and you travel really fast, it's amazing to me how long it took us to go from sort of near Tilbury to Lincolnshire. But it took us all day. Anyway, we stopped in Cambridge, I remember, and had a brew up. And I realised we had all these rations on board, what was left from the compo packs. And I knew what would happen. They'd go back into the cookhouse, and that's the last anyone would see of them. So I said, look, boys, you can take whatever you can carry. You know, they all had packs and so on. So they all helped themselves. And what was left over, we gave it to the people in the road where we'd brewed up. This is a deep rationing was on at that time, you know. If people got that much butter, they thought that was good enough for a week, and we gave them a big tin and stuff. It was quite sort of entertaining for half an hour. People were a bit suspicious. They thought we'd been knocked off, you know, in the way I suppose it was. But anyway, army rations. And we returned to our units. And the South Staffs went off to their units, and we returned to Heckington, and the next day we went on leave. It was by then something like the end of October, early November. It was sad you're returning to the unit, because something like two-thirds of the unit were either killed or prisoners of war. So there were very few men left. Anyway, nonetheless, it was nice to go off on leave. You want me to carry on, do you?
Please.
Right, well, the division had been so badly mauled, this 1st Airborne Division, it must have been touch and go whether they didn't just disband it. However, they decided to put it together again, and they made it up into a 2-brigade division, by shuffling people around. And round about just after Christmas, it must have been. Or was it before Christmas? Well, anyway, round about that time, so probably about a month after we came home, we started to get men came in large numbers and guns and jeeps and all the various things that were our lives. And we set about training these men. We were very lucky there, because they had disbanded the Maritime AK-AK regiment. This was a regiment that they stuck a few gunners on a merchant ship with a gun. So if a submarine showed up, they could have a shot at it. Well, I don't know how much gunnery they indulged in, but the fact is they learned how to look after themselves on board ship, and they were soldiers who knew how to look after themselves. We also got a number of fellows who were reinforcements, because they were wounded in Normandy and recovered and volunteered to come and join us. A lot of very good chaps. And so the battery and the rest of the division got itself back in action, back in effective efficiency quite quickly. And certainly by the end of March, you know, we were ready to go again.
Where were you at this time?
Heckington in Lincolnshire. The division had been in that part of Lincolnshire and Leicestershire, you know, from that area there, before it went to Arnhem, and they just returned to wherever they were and reorganised themselves. And new officers and men came in, and we all sort of got stuck in, and it became an efficient unit once again. And I'm sure the other units did much the same. And the training programs went on, various gunnery and parachute courses and glider trips, and used to go over to Leicester Forest East, learn how to load gliders and flying gliders. And of course, the parachute school was at Ringway in Manchester, which is now Manchester Airport, so men went up there. Took about a fortnight, and they came back and was qualified as parachutists, and were paid a princely sum of about another 6 months a day, I think, or Something like that. What is sixpence? That's about 2p.
It's the 40th of a pound.
Well, there you are. That's what we were paid per day. Because we were qualified as parachutists. Mind you, with inflation, you know, these things all take on a different value. And it might have been more than that, I can't remember. There were then various alerts. And you weren't too sure whether it was, whether they were just an exercise. You see, you could see that the Allied armies, in particular the British army, were sort of storming across Germany. We then all disappeared off to airfields and got ready for what could be an air operation. And gliders were loaded and all the usual paraphernalia. Well, we weren't briefed for anywhere. You looked at the map, it was the Elbe. The next river to cross was the Elbe, so that the logical thing was to go and do an airborne operation on the Elbe. Anyway, it didn't come off. Suddenly we were told to unload the gliders and get and return to wherever we were told to return to. I remember I had to report to my unit in Thetford. And I got this instruction sort of early afternoon one day. There was a feeling of, well, the war is about to finish. Mm-hmm. And the war in Europe. And there was a certain amount of lightness in the air because of it. And so we decided that I wasn't going to get to Thetford that night. I wasn't going to get there anyway that night. It's a long way from Tarrant Rushton in Dorset to Thetford in Norfolk or Suffolk, wherever it is. And to which, having got there, I'd have to find the battery wherever it was hidden away. So we went up, we bivouacked in Hyde Park, just by the Serpentine. And mounted a guard, and the rest of us all went down into Oxford Street and had a meal in Lion's Corner House, which we thought was no end of an adventure. You know, you might take such things for granted, but that was quite exciting. Nobody made any comments about it. I didn't dare tell my battery commander. I didn't think he had sufficient sense of humour. I did later on tell the colonel, who I knew would laugh his head off, and he did. Anyway, having spent the night there, we trundled off down through central London. The police held up the traffic, let us through, because we'd occupied a lot of space with four guns, four 17-pounder guns. I suppose I had headquarters as well. And we joined the battery at Thetford and went back to Heckington in Lincolnshire. And, you know, the war was finishing very fast. Anyway, I can't remember how it all happened. The next we knew, we all flew to Norway. The 1st Airborne Division flew to Norway to take the surrender of Scandinavia. The way it was done was that the air landing brigade went to Oslo, the artillery went to Stavanger, and the 1st Power Brigade went to Copenhagen. And sort of quite an air armada went off, and we landed there. And
so you went to Stavanger?
Went to Stavanger.
What was that like?
Didn't see much of it, actually. Anyway, we hadn't been, you know, it was only about an hour or so after we all landed at the airfield. It was decided to send a patrol into Stavanger. And strangely enough, it was an officer's patrol. There's something absurd about an officer's patrol, but anyway, it was, they were all officers who went. And we drove in, so a convoy jeep sent us from Stavanger. And the crowds on the side of the road, you know, made it very difficult to get through. Stavanger was having a party. You know, the war had finished. And if the occupied people, you know, took a very different view from anybody else.